I'm George Liston, C.A. The historian Thomas Carlyle was first to observe that the history of the world is but the biography of great men. The conduct of the great crusades, those cataclysmic struggles between Occident and Orient, Christianity and Islam, offer telling proof of this observation. Set above powerful but faceless theological and geopolitical issues was the stirring, charismatic example of leaders who themselves became forces in their own right. No two men better portray this than Richard the Lionheart and Saladin, who championed the armies of Christianity and Islam during the Third Crusade. My guest today is James Reston, Jr., author of Warriors of God. Jim, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you, George.
Marvelous book. Let's get that out of the way right at the start.
It's a ripping
good read, I mean, as well as great history. So
it's meant to be that way,
well,
George.
It does. It's a page-turner. To set the stage for our conversation, Jim, let me try this on you. The call to arms for the First Crusade was given, as I understand, by Pope Urban II, and he saw that as largely a way of distracting the otherwise conflicted knights and kings of Europe who were engaged in internecine warfare endlessly, giving them something larger to fight against, so to speak. But to my reading, Jim, through this book, throughout the book, from the First Crusade well into through the Third Crusade that you depict here, internecine conflict and rivalry was an enduring subtext. Is that right?
Absolutely, it was. I think that sentiment of the Vatican very much carried over into the period of the Third Crusade, 80 years or so after the First Crusade. Yes.
Mm-hmm. For example, Richard the Third, or Richard the First, rather, in the Third Crusade, towards the very end of it, is sort of himself powerfully distracted by things going on back in England, a rivalry on the part of his younger brother and so forth. And the knights that he's with in places like Acre and Ascalon and Jaffa seem to be constantly sort of jousting amongst themselves for control and power.
Absolutely. It doesn't change, does mm-hmm. it? So this is an eternal theme, but you're absolutely right that the internecine warfare was very rife in Europe before the Third Crusade, and Richard becomes really the finest of this breed, if you're talking about the bravery in battle and skill in battle. So he really is the preeminent warrior of Europe before Saladin destroys the kingdom of Jerusalem. So it was appropriate that he would lead the Third Crusade.
Yeah. I want to focus on all of these characters. They're extremely colorful, and I might say multi-dimensional. For example, Richard Lionheart, who's familiar to, I guess, practically everyone listening, if not through history, certainly through the many film presentations that have been made of this colorful story, is himself a very complex figure, is he not?
He's extremely complex. He's the son of Eleanor of Aquitaine, who herself is an extraordinary figure and was a crusader in the Second Crusade, actually. And he grew up in her court in Poitiers,
right,
where she held this amazing court of women, primarily, who had discourses like Socrates had about politics. They had discourses about love and the relationship of men and women. And it was Eleanor's article of faith and deep credo that women were not only equal to men, but superior to men, and that men were kind of the benighted sort. Out of this, Richard grows up, and it's very clear in his teenage years that he is a homosexual.
Mm.
So this certainly gave great dimension and complexity to not only his own personality, but to his relationships with other potentates in Europe.
Right.
In particular, the King of France,
Philip Augustus. And in fact, that is one of the most richly portrayed and complex of relationships in the book. For example, you depict Richard the First and Philip Augustus as lovers, but also as extreme rivals and deeply contrasting characters. I mean, it's, as I say, once again, multidimensional. On many layers, these men are both comrades and competitors.
Yes, well, I was glad that you mentioned Thomas Carlyle in your opening, because I did attempt, and I've always attempted in my work, to personalize history as much as possible. That's the lens through which Carlyle saw history, and the lens through which I see it also. So I have portrayed this as a kind of mano a mano struggle between Richard the Lionheart and Saladin, but the relationship between Richard and his allies is extremely complicated, very rich and very interesting. And I mean, you don't have to be, you know, a king to get into complex relationship if any two gay men fall out, and then have to subsequently become partners in some sort of a enterprise grander than themselves. You know that's going to be very complicated. So for Richard and Philip to be ex-lovers and present allies in a great, holy, epic struggle, well, I just thought that was wonderful.
One of the great strengths of this book, Jim, is, of course, its depiction of not just the actions, but the motivations from the Islamic side, from the Arab side. And to help us begin to understand that, tell us, first of all, what the European conquest of Palestine in 1098 meant to the Arab world. Was that a bone of massive historical contention, or what precisely?
It was extremely interesting for me to, beyond my library research, which was done largely in the Library of Congress, to go twice to the Middle East and to spend time with Arab scholars, Arab medievalists, because the Western canon usually refers to five crusades, and they all get melded together in the popular mind. It was just the crusades. They were all the same, and they weren't all the same, and they happened over a period of 200 years or so. But if the Western mind thinks of five crusades in 200 years, the Arab attitude towards this is quite different, that they really see this period in three phases, three sections. The first is the success, as it were, of the First Crusade, which captures Jerusalem and establishes the Kingdom of Jerusalem. And that was a small state, not much larger than the current-day Israel.
This is the Latin Kingdom?
The Latin Kingdom of Jerusalem. It extends from just below Turkey down to the Red Sea, so it was a bit larger than current-day Israel, but nevertheless very slender and therefore very vulnerable to the Arab masses all around it. And as the Arab mind sees it, the history of the 12th century is really the capture of Jerusalem, the establishment of that kingdom, and then a long struggle to unite Arab forces of Egypt and Syria into a formidable challenge to this state. And it is Saladin who consummates this union of Egypt and Syria, not that different from what happened in the 1950s with Nasser in Egypt with his United Arab Republic. And the notion was that if you could unite those two parts of the Arab world, you could succeed in pushing the invaders, the colonists, into the sea. So the second part of that struggle after the loss of Jerusalem to the Arabs is the long 50 or 60 or 70 year struggle to unite the Arab peoples, to mobilize Arab lands to make a final assault on the Crusader kingdom. And that happens with Saladin and with the triumph of Saladin at the Battle of Hattin in 1187.
Now, let me try this, Jim, and correct it immediately if it's too much of an oversimplification. But given what you've just said, it seems to me that the predominant Arab interest in all of this was geopolitical, forging this unified empire, if you will, of Syria and Egypt, whereas the Pope and the Westerners were looking at this in a sort of, at least ostensibly, in a very theological context of recapturing Jerusalem, recapturing the true cross and the place of, you know, such eminent religious importance to them.
Well, except that it was just as intense from the religious standpoint for the Arab world as it was.
Jerusalem is the third most important city to them.
That's correct. That it is really, they argue, just as holy to Islam as it is to Christianity. And who could dispute them? I mean, this is the place from which Muhammad descended into heaven
right. In
his nocturnal journey, and it's the place where all Muslims are meant to gather on their day of judgment. And Saladin says all this in his negotiations with Richard towards the end of the thing. So this heightens the vibrance and intensity of the struggle that there are deep believers of equal depth.
When you get to material like this and characters, if you will, of such extraordinary appeal as Richard and Saladin, was the very contrast between these two men also kind of a magnet for you to write this story? For example, Richard comes across to me, first of all, he really sort of betrays the homosexual stereotype. Here's a man who's very athletic, a great general, and as I say, first in battle and so forth, and very impulsive, I thought. Contrasted with Saladin, who, again, to my reading, is a very meditative, reflective, almost ethereal figure in many ways. But did that kind of thing appeal to you as a historian and writer?
And dramatist,
yeah, exactly.
You see, I mean, this is to die for, that you would have two equal figures of equal power. I mean, these are true giants. And it's a much, much better story when you have two giants of equal power and equal personal magnetism than if you have a kind of a beauty and a beast or a great man and a lesser man. You know, this is actually my second dual biography, and the first one was a baseball book about Pete Rose and Bart Giamatti. Mm-hmm. And so I was very, you know, I'm very interested in the literary form of dual biography. But one is somewhat hamstrung by history. I mean, there are these kinds of great stories with two figures of equal power just don't exist on the trees.
Mm-hmm. One of the things when we talk about them as equal figures of equal power was, again, and particularly toward the concluding phases of the Crusade, they were, at least through prominent intermediaries, very often in contact. I mean, there's a lot of negotiating going on back and forth. And again, it's depicted with a lot of dialogue and sort of language of the period. I'm interested in two things, Jim. Your sense of that as you wrote it, your reaction to having this kind of detail at your grasp. And then secondly, how you did that. I mean, particularly in terms of the, I'll use the word dialogue that we get, the statements of both men.
Yes. I was a scholar in residence at the Library of Congress when I did this book, and the Library of Congress is the greatest library in the world, has all the chronicles of the Crusades, and I was able to just simply put these on a great shelf in front of me, you know, the various chronicles. There are a number of them from the western side, but there are also some critical ones from the eastern side, and these chronicles have dialogue in them. And so this again is something that's my 11th book. I began writing novels. I know the importance of dialogue in terms of putting the reader in a scene. So anytime I can find an actual quotation in a chronicle 800 years old, well, that's absolutely golden for me. But in this case, you have this extraordinary denouement of the Third Crusade after Richard gets right to the gates of Jerusalem. And it's just basically there as ripe fruit for him to pick. And I think has this extraordinary failure of courage. Here, this most courageous of all people.
Yeah.
And what happens thereafter is a kind of long, slow exit strategy for Richard, in which he's in intense negotiation with Saladin. And that is very well chronicled, including with the quotations.
Mm-hmm.
So it enabled me to really give a kind of novelistic feel to the real history.
Got a lot of things to ask you, and I want to come back to those days. I guess it was at Jaffa, the last confrontation between the two forces and the two men in particular. Let me take a moment from our conversation just to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest today is James Reston, Jr., author of Warriors of God, published by Doubleday. Jim, I, as a reader, I'm glad you said there was some failure of nerve on Richard's part at the very end there, because I, quite frankly, found that extremely puzzling. From Acre to Ascalon, I guess, down to Jaffa, within miles, single-digit miles of Jerusalem, I guess perhaps able to see it, and going from periods of elation to despair among the Christian warriors. I mean, with all that, I was just struck by the fact that all of a sudden there's this collapse of nerve. He just does not want to do it anymore. You just think it was just that?
Well, that's the overall characterization that I give to the thing. There were there were distressing things that he was dealing with. We know from Shakespeare that King John, his younger brother, was doing his level best to steal his throne and his realm from Richard while he was in the Holy Land, and was putting out the story that Richard would surely die there anyway. And it had gotten into kind of very close, indeed it was civil war in England between the forces of King or John, Richard's brother, and those defenders of Richard who said he was still alive and which was coming back, so that there were a number of messages sent to Richard saying, you've got to come home because you're about to lose your realm. You may win the holy war and you'll come back and find no kingdom at all. So things were collapsing at home. Even Eleanor suggests and urges him to give it up and come home. So that's one important pull on Richard. The other thing that's important to this comes out of the lore of the First Crusade, where this enormous effort went forward to capture the holy sites. And when they did capture them, all the soldiers said, well, hey, okay, we're here, we've done what we came to do, we're going home. Okay, and they had a terrible time in populating the kingdom of Jerusalem once they had captured it. This clearly was on Richard's mind. What would happen if they captured Jerusalem, and how would they hold it? Because Saladin was so formidable. So Richard felt, I think, that this might be end up being a hopeless act, that you might briefly hold Jerusalem, and then everybody would go home, and Saladin would very quickly take it over. So what was the point?
A victory could almost be a paradox. You would win, but then lose because you couldn't populate it. We should also mention at this point that Saladin's, well, I can't say his actions, but it seems to me that he was also surrounded by some doubt, confusion, and even controversy toward the end himself, wasn't he? I mean, he seemed to, throughout the Crusade as I read it, enjoy the almost unmitigated admiration of his men, and particularly his emirs and those of the highest rank close to him. But I did begin to think, Jim, that there were doubts raised about his leadership of Arab forces, particularly in the latter days of the Third Crusade.
Well, definitely so. I think when we think about Oriental potentates, we're inclined to think that they had everything completely in control. Not in the least. Not in this vast empire from Libya all the way up to Russia, which is an enormous empire that he was holding. And he had united these forces, but it was really a kind of a mirror image of Europe in that sense, that there were small emirs and sultans and potentates all over his kingdom who were not all that comfortable with this emperor at the top. Moreover, Saladin made some mistakes along the way for which he paid dearly. Most especially, the most important mistake that he made was to leave a toehold for the Crusaders in Acre, so that when Richard came with his vast navy and army, or I'm not in Acre, in Tyre, they had a place to uh, they had a place to mobilize, and Saladin certainly had the ability to complete the job and take Tyre and push the crusade, all crusaders, completely into the ocean. But he didn't do that. It gave, as I say, Richard a beachhead. It gave the remaining forces from the defeat at the Battle of Hattin a place to kind of regroup and then attempt to lay siege to the city of Acre. So, so he, you know, there was a lot of challenge to Saladin within within his own
group.
Do
you think it's a fair statement that we're talking about all-out war here, and we're talking about massive confrontations of at times enormous brutality? But again, my sense that Saladin exercised more restraint, or was a more restrained sort of strategic general than Richard might have been. I mean, this business of leaving the enemy a toehold, or pulling back, or even in his treatment of prisoners, or his conception of victory, he seemed to be a bit more moderate, if you will.
Well, certainly so. I mean, in, when he captures Jerusalem, he negotiates with the defeated crusaders about a retreat, and allows them to retreat and then to mobilize in Tyre. So that was a military mistake, and he paid for it in spades. You know, there is that restraint militarily, but there's other episodes that are almost more dramatic to me, most especially when he captures Jerusalem, recaptures Jerusalem from the crusaders, that that there are many in his own circle that say that they should just reduce the Christian holy sites to dust, you know. And one of the greatnesses of Saladin was that he said, "No, it is not to be a good Muslim to do this to the holy sites of other religions." And and that is something that certainly in today's world gets lost, that that any Arab great leader could be great partly by generosity.
Well, I think this is one of the services, if I may put it that way, of the book, because we're introduced to, I hope I don't phrase this too awkwardly, but a kind of a traditional Arab sense of chivalry, of conduct in warfare, of notions of what creed and code are appropriate to conflict, that at least for most of us lay people in the West is simply not you know, a matter of current thought.
Yes, well, I think that's a contribution of this book. I found very quickly getting into this that crusade studies were kind of bifurcated between, you know, Cambridge, England, on the one hand, that tends to be very Eurocentric and concentrate on the Christian side of thing, and the Arab side gets takes a very deep back seat. And the Arab treatment of the Crusades elevates Saladin into the demigod status. Well, here I come as an American writer, not trained in Cambridge under the great Cambridge historians that would give me a set view. So I was liberated from that, and wanting to give equal treatment to the Arab side, but wanting to humanize Saladin in his greatness and also in his humanity. So that is a quest that I've always attempted in anything I've done over the last 30 years, because that's how you bring human beings alive.
Today, as we know, Saladin, I think, rests in Damascus, and Richard is buried in Rouen. And as you point out in the conclusion of the book, those who took part in that crusade achieved at least one goal, and that was martyrdom on either side, at least those who, in vast numbers unknown, I guess, to us, but enormous by any count, did die. But the question remains for our time, Jim, as to what from those crusades comes forth to this day as a matter of passionate influence, and I can think of no one better to ask that than you.
Well, I have always sought in my historical work to focus on subjects that has some resonance for the current day, and it's been very pleasing to me and that readers have told me that they understand the current struggles in the Middle East much better for having read this book, that we know that these issues go back at least 800 years. If you read carefully that dialogue between Richard and Saladin in the exit strategy that I referred to, some of the things that Saladin says, you know, could really come out of the mouth of Yasser Arafat today about the importance of Jerusalem and how we will never give it up and how important it is to the Muslims, equally important to Muslims as it is to the Jews. Saladin in this case is saying equally important as it is to the Christians. So there certainly is that insight here that these issues are almost as deep as history itself. I've been very glad for that. It's also a danger, however, to a storyteller like myself who wants to tell just a wonderful tale here as richly as it can be and yet wants to have a resonance to the current day, that I'm immediately drawn into discussions of current day Middle East politics wherever I go with this book. And if I say something extremely positive about Saladin, some people will consider that to be an anti-Jewish statement of some sort or another, because it is the fact that Saladin is invoked all the time in current day Arab ideology as what they are shooting for in the current situation. So Saladin is a very vibrant, immediate, relevant figure to the current Arab world. And that's exciting to me.
And I think you, through your depiction of him in this book, explain why he is so vivid and, I dare say, such a living presence in the Arab world today. And in that sense, Jim, as in so many others, you do us all, I think, a great service. So thank you for Warriors of God.
Thank you, George.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was James Reston, Jr., author of Warriors of God, published by Doubleday. I'm George Liston, CA, producer and host of Dialogue. Our associate producer is Karen Dale. Our technical director is John Tyler. And our assistant producer is Rachel Edmonds. Our production assistant is Thomas Hayes. Dialogue is presented by PRI Public Radio International and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
To order a Dialogue program or for more information, contact us at 202-691-4146. You can also listen to Dialogue on the web at wilsoncenter.org/dialogue. Email us on America Online at radiodial@aol.com. That's radiodial@aol.com.